Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Thanks for listening. Do rate us. Do tell your friends about us. We have a wonderful guest today, Dr. Scott Sicher, and I'm probably mispronouncing his name. It's S-I-C-H-E-R-E-R, is the director of the Jaffe Food Allergy Institute and the Ellen and Rosalind Jaffe Professor of Pediatric Allergy and Immunology at the Icahn School of Medicine at, if you will, Mount Sinai Hospital. And he's the chief of the Division of Pediatric Allergy. So he knows an awful lot about kids' allergies. He's actually written a book on it, Food Allergies, A Complete Guide to Eating When Your Life Depends on It, from Johns Hopkins Press. Scott, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Now, let's first go, when someone has a food allergy that isn't immediate, in other words, if they have an immediate allergy, what happens? And then what happens if they have a food allergy that isn't immediate? How do they know about it?
Well, a food allergy is the immune system, the part of the body that usually helps us do things like fight infection, essentially causing a bad thing to happen because it's attacking the protein in the food. So the most common way that happens is more of a sudden onset type of symptom. So that could include skin symptoms like hives, you know, like kind of like mosquito bite looking rash, swelling of the skin. It can affect breathing with trouble breathing, wheezing like an asthma attack, coughing and trouble with air getting through the throat. And it can affect the stomach with pain and vomiting. At its worst, it can also affect blood circulation. Someone, you know, can have reduced blood pressure and get dizzy and disoriented and pass out, and potentially a very severe allergic reaction could be fatal. You asked to distinguish that against a more chronic type of symptom from a food allergy.
So immediately, let me go. So immediately the person could feel a very life-threatening illness with a inability to breathe. What would be a chronic, if you will, reaction?
So some chronic issues that have been attributed to food allergy would include chronic eczema rashes, so itchy skin rashes that happen in particular areas of the body, like in children. It could be in the inside of the elbows and knees and around the neck, and older individuals could be more around the neck and such. So those chronic rashes of eczema, we call atopic dermatitis, could be associated with food allergy. There could be some chronic stomach issues associated with food allergy, where people have trouble with food going down and they get pain with eating, or food gets stuck in their throat. Most of the problems with food allergy, though, are the immediate type reactions.
And now you're studying, congratulations, you got a huge grant from NIH, $7.5 million to study studied area in peanut allergy. There's been a lot of studies on what you might call immediate allergy with small doses of peanuts. What you're doing now, and how does that present?
Yeah, so peanut allergy is one of the more common food allergies. It tends to be often very severe. It's a food allergy that, for children, unlike allergies to things like egg, milk, wheat, soy that are common but tend to go away, peanut allergy tends to stick around for a lifetime more often. It's responsible for most of the deaths from food allergy that occur. So it's a bad actor, the peanut allergy. And so there's a lot of attention that's to it. Some really exciting things going on right now are therapies that are in sort of final phases of studies toward FDA approval to try to make life safer for people who are exquisitely allergic to peanut. But there's also a subgroup of individuals with a peanut allergy that have serious allergic reactions to peanut, but don't react at these trace amounts that are the focus of some of the therapies that have been looked at so far. About half of the people with peanut allergy react to amounts of peanut that are quite visible, like half a peanut or a whole peanut. They can't eat the food, and if they accidentally get some, they get sick from it. And we're focusing this particular study on those individuals for a variety of reasons. One is that they
Hold on a second. So let me get this again. So you're focusing on the people who get how much peanut, how much do they get sick with?
So individuals who are reacting to, let's call it more than like a third of a peanut.
Oh, so people get really sick with just a little bit of the dust. That's the group that's been focused on.
Yeah, and rightly so, because those individuals obviously, you know, have a big problem, a small amount of exposure and, you know, a food that they've ordered at a restaurant or whatnot, you know, could make them very sick. But there's also an opportunity, and those individuals, the ones who are reactive to this very small amount, are the focus of these treatments that are being looked at in a variety of places across the globe, really, to try to treat those allergies. But I think, you know, we also want to learn from individuals who aren't so exquisitely reactive to these tiny amounts. There are people who don't react until they have more than those tiny amounts. They have a higher threshold of reactivity, but they also have to avoid the food. They also can have severe reactions, and they have to watch out and change their lifestyle because of the allergy. But they might also be people, from studies that we've seen so far, that may actually be more treatable, people who we may even be able to cure the allergy. So we're looking at this group as well.
And so tell us what you're doing in the study, and are you through with recruiting, or if people want to get in the study, how would they go about doing that?
Well, let me take a step back. So we're doing many studies at the Jaffe Food Allergy Institute. Many of the studies that we do are being done at many different places across the country who share in, you know, trying to get a treatment or a cure, hopefully eventually, for people with food allergies. So we're looking at a variety of approaches for people with food allergy, and it's really exciting because there are a thing called oral immunotherapy, which is giving, and don't try this at home, giving tiny amounts of a food that someone's allergic to and gradually increasing amounts. There's like a patch, almost like a nicotine patch for food allergy that we're looking at, where someone wears this to try to reduce their allergy. We're looking at injection of what we call biologics. These are essentially created molecules that will interrupt certain aspects of allergic responses to try to make things safer for people with food allergy. We're looking at allergy shot types of treatments. People are familiar with this for hay fever or for insect sting allergy, where you get allergy shots and then that helps you with the allergy. So we're looking at a whole bunch of approaches for people with peanut and other food allergies. The study that we just got this grant for, which hasn't started yet, we're actually just doing here at Mount Sinai, and this is, you know, trying to learn more about people who have this higher threshold allergy where they can eat more than that little dust amount that you were talking about before, because we're hoping that we can learn from those individuals about what we can do for them and also what's different about them that they react at this higher amount, because that might, if we could learn more about that, we might be able to apply that also to the people who react to the tiny amounts and find better ways to treat them as well.
And so, and I missed, is there a recruitment process? Is there a website they can go and sign up if for example,
people who are listening will be able to find this study on clinicaltrials.gov when it starts, which is anticipated to begin in the beginning of 2019. So we're not recruiting yet. And what that study is going to do is it's going to have people who have peanut allergy. We'll bring them in to see how sensitive they are. Are they able to only eat a teeny tiny amount before they have symptoms, or can they eat a larger amount before they have symptoms, or maybe they think they're allergic and it turns out that they actually are not and can eat a full serving of peanut butter without any symptoms. Each of those three groups, the ones who are exquisitely sensitive to the tiny amounts, the ones who are in the middle, and the ones who are not, turn out that they're not even allergic, we're going to be doing laboratory studies from blood samples and other samples to understand what differentiates those three different situations. And then for those who are able to ingest a little bit of peanut butter before they get a reaction to it, we're going to actually have them go ahead and eat a little bit under supervision in a very regimented way to see if that can stimulate their body to gradually get rid of the allergy.
And so do they have to come to New York to get in the study, or are there...
this study is going to be at Mount Sinai.
And now are there people who, for example, take a, get a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and can eat that, but get later symptoms, any GI symptoms, or is that not an allergy, or is that very uncommon with peanut butter?
It would be extremely uncommon. So there's a rare illness where people have severe vomiting. They could even end up having low blood pressure about 2 hours after eating a food. Peanut is not the most common trigger of that, although it can do it. This is not at all common in adults, seen more in children. And we call it food protein-induced enterocolitis syndrome. That's a particular kind of food allergy where the symptoms come on 2 hours after eating the food, and it's very dramatic. Like, people go to the emergency room because of it, because they're vomiting so much and they get so sick from it. It's a different kind of reaction. In terms of the immediate type of reactions that we were talking about before with the breathing symptoms and the circulation symptoms, those symptoms usually come on within minutes of eating a food, and, you know, at the far point, maybe they would start an hour or very rarely an hour and a half or 2 hours after eating the food. But it would be very unusual to have, you know, those types of symptoms of hives and things like that happening, you know, many hours after a food is eaten. That's very unusual.
So now tell us a little more about the protocol you're going to use. In other words, do the people get randomly allocated to one or two treatments, or are there a whole bunch of potential alternatives
With this particular study, as I mentioned before, first we have to figure out where they fall on the spectrum of being allergic to peanut in this case. So if they're very sensitive to tiny amounts, then we learn from them by taking, you know, blood tests and such. We learn what, you know, we're trying to learn how to identify individuals like that and to learn more about what we can do to treat them as well. But those are the individuals that were doing other studies to try to treat their food allergy, their peanut allergy. If the individual has a higher threshold of peanut allergy, then they technically wouldn't be qualifying for a lot of the treatments that are in the pipeline right now. They're kind of, you know, the forgotten group. And those are the ones that we'll be looking at for an intervention in this particular study. And what will happen is, we don't know if it's better to just say, hey, look, you know, you're allergic to peanut, but, you know, just keep not eating it and just go on, you know, with your life and we'll leave it alone, versus saying, let's see what would happen if we let you eat a small amount that doesn't trigger an allergic reaction, that your body can handle that lesser amount. And then have you eat that for a period of time daily, kind of like a medicine, and then gradually have you eat more each day. This approach is being done with people who have the more exquisite allergy to the small amounts, and actually pharmacologic amounts of peanut are being looked at in those studies. But this study is looking at the people who fall into that higher threshold group, and we're thinking that this group, this, you know, higher threshold group, might actually be easier to make not allergic to peanut through exposure. For individuals who have a low threshold of allergy, what we found so far is that we usually, for a large percentage of them, can increase their threshold to make things safer, but it doesn't really push them into very high, the ability to tolerate very high amounts. So they also are still vulnerable if they, you know, if they eat a larger amount. And it doesn't seem like it cures them. So it just maybe raises the amount that they can eat temporarily while they're having it as a medicine daily. But if they stop taking that daily small dose of peanut, then they go back to being allergic again. We're thinking that these higher threshold people, the ones who can have, you know, let's call it a peanut or two without symptoms, but more would give them symptoms, that we might be able to actually get them to a point where they're not allergic anymore, where their body has gotten to accept peanut and get rid of the allergy entirely. In the meantime, we're doing laboratory studies to look at how the body responds and why the body responds one way or another when it's exposed to the allergen as a treatment, or just even by accidental exposure when someone's avoiding it.
And let's talk about allergies in general, if we can. So how on every milk carton or whatever, you see that there's a list of the allergens that you see, and peanuts are always in number one position as the most common. But there are, what is it, 8 common allergens?
Yeah, so there are over 170 foods that people have had documented allergic reactions to, but there's a small group that account for most of the problems. Milk, egg, wheat, soy, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish. Those individual foods or food categories account for most of the problems. Sesame is probably number 9 on the list of 8. But these are the foods that are more common to cause reactions and a little bit more common for more severe reactions, especially with foods like peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish. There are also people who have very severe reactions to milk. So, you know, you could imagine that it could be very difficult to avoid a food like milk, which is so ubiquitous.
Now,
so it's a real life.
How common, if you look at it, is it 10% of kids have allergies? Is it 2%? What percent of?
Yeah, so it's estimated that about 8% of children and about 4 or 5% of adults have food allergies. Again, some of the foods for children like milk, egg, wheat, and soy are typically outgrown, although not always, during childhood. And so the rate of significant allergy is generally lower in adults than in children because they outgrow it. Some people have allergies to foods that are milder. For example, a lot of people have fruit or vegetable allergies where they just get an itchy mouth or a little itchy throat, but nothing severe. That probably affects about 10 or 12% of the population. It's actually something that we call pollen-related food allergy, because some people who have hay fever from different pollens, those same proteins that are in the pollens are, because the way nature did this, it made it parts of certain foods. So for those people, raw fruits and vegetables that have those pollen-like proteins in them will give them an itchy mouth. So there are a lot of individuals who have some of these less severe food allergies. But as I mentioned before, about 8% of children, 4 or 5% of adults with the more significant food allergies.
And now the if you will, there are deaths and hospitalizations from food allergies. Is that right?
Sure. And so a lot of studies over the years have shown what seems to be an increase in food allergy in general, peanut allergy in particular. We have data that we're saying that back in 97, when we looked, about 1 in 250 children had a peanut allergy. And when we looked again 11 years after that, it was 1 in 70, so it had tripled. And studies are suggesting that more people are ending up in the emergency room with allergic reactions to foods. So there does seem to be an increase in the prevalence of the allergy, and certainly people have severe allergies, and that's why we teach people to avoid the food and to carry medications like self-injectable epinephrine so that they can treat a severe allergic reaction promptly and then get to an emergency room for more help.
We're talking with Dr. Scott Sicherer, and I'm mispronouncing the name badly. It's S-I-C-H-E-R-E-R. He is the Elliott and Rosalind Jaffe Professor of Pediatric Allergy and Immunology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital, and he is director of the Jaffe Food Allergy Institute there. He's also written a book, Food Allergies, A Complete Guide to Eating When Your Life Depends on It, by Johns Hopkins Press. So, Scott, if there's a takeaway for us, what is the takeaway relating to, if you will, peanut allergy? Is the prediction, if you had to make a prediction, is it that if we stick with this type of research, we will be able to eliminate the adverse effects of allergies, or we'll be able to eliminate people having allergies, or where do you think we'll go?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, as I just mentioned, we've had an increase in food allergies in general. So it's become, you know, almost an epidemic of this. And the amazing thing is, if we were having this conversation, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, I'd have relatively little to say in terms of specific things that are in the pipeline to change lives for people with food allergies. Now, I can pretty easily say that there are things that are just on the verge of being FDA approved for treatment And there are so many things in the pipeline that are hopeful for treatment that I really think the next few years, patients are going to be weighing, like, should I try this treatment or should I try that treatment, which is very different than just saying, well, I'm just going to manage this by not eating the food. And we're going to, I think, get into a personalized approach where we're going to hopefully be able to do simple things like a blood test to identify what the best route of treatment will be for an individual. That's obviously going to evolve as the years go by because I think we'll have better medications to treat it as well. But this is an exciting, rapidly developing area with a lot of hope and change. And we're even learning about prevention of allergy. And we now have some solid information to give families about preventing peanut allergy. And we're doing more studies to learn about prevention of other food allergies as well.
I just want to thank you very much. We've been talking with Scott Sicher. Obviously, he has a huge research grant, and that is to study the prevention of these allergies and what can be done to literally prevent them. We've had I think it's a really upbeat thought that we are going to get to be able to prevent them, or at least prevent a lot of the adverse effects that someplace around 4% of adults and 8% of children now have, and have to really be quite careful in avoiding these foods. As he said, milk and some other of the products are almost ubiquitous and make it tough to go, I suppose, to eat out or to eat when you're not absolutely sure of what's in the product. Thanks very much, Scott. And thanks also to the, if you will, the Jaffe Center at Mount Sinai for doing so much to help us understand and prevent the consequences of food allergy. You've been listening to You, the Owner's Manual podcast 916B. We should thank Darian for engineering, and thank you for downloading us and listening. And of course, to thank Scott Sicher, S-I-C-H-E-R-E-R, at the Jaffe Center at Mount Sinai. Thanks again.